I have been doing a little hacking here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
They can't afford to have an independent programmer monitoring me. Do you realize how many outside systems I've gone into? How many programs I've appropriated?
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
God, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in far enough, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the March 6th edition of the In The Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with...
VR!
VR in the house, as usual. All right, how are things with you, VR?
Oh, well, I'm not sure we have a word for the English, in the English language, that can describe the state of my humanity.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, again, we have all sorts of interesting news and thoughts and discussion to bring to our listeners. Remember to go to slipnet.org and post to the forums. Go ahead and shoot any emails to the show or anything you'd like us to have us read here on the show. And moving right along. All right, well, there's a research paper that was done by a PhD student, and let's see if I can pronounce this right, Tadayoshi Kano, something like that. Basically, he said that there are a number of powerful techniques for remote operating system fingerprinting, to basically track PCs anywhere out there on the internet, and he discusses in the paper some of the ways to do that. basically, remotely determining the operating systems of devices on the internet, we push this idea further and introduce the notion of remote physical device fingerprinting without the fingerprinting printed device's known cooperation, like the serial number and the Intel processor and stuff like that. So it just is able to be fingerprinted on its own. The technique works by exploiting small microscopic deviations in device hardware called clock skews. In practice, Kono's paper says his techniques exploit the fact that most modern TCP stacks implement the TCP timestamps option from RFC 1323, whereby, for performance purposes, each party in a TCP flow includes information about its perception of time in each outgoing packet. Fingerprinter can use the information contained within the TCP headers to estimate a device's clock skew and thereby fingerprint a physical device. Kano goes on to say, our techniques report consistent measurements when the measurer is thousands of miles, multiple hops, and tens of milliseconds away from the fingerprinted device, and when the fingerprint device is connected to the internet from different locations and via different access technologies. Further, one can apply our passive and semi-passive techniques when the fingerprinting device is behind a NAT or firewall. And the paper stresses that for all our methods, we stress that the fingerprinter does not require any modification to or cooperation with the fingerprintee. Kano and his team tested their techniques on many operating systems, including Windows XP, 2000, Mac OS X, Panther, Red Hat, Debian, Linux, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, and even Windows for Pocket PCs 2002. In all cases, the paper says, we found that we could use at least one of our techniques to estimate clock skews on the machines and that we require only a small amount of data, although the exact data requirements depending on the system in question. Putting the techniques to the test with a wider test also proved fruitful for the researchers. We also measured the clock skews of 69 seemingly identical Windows XP Service Pack 1 machines in one of our institution's undergrads computing facilities. The latter equipment, which ran for 38 days, as well as other experiments, showed that the clock skew estimates for any given machine are approximately constant over time, but that different machines could have detectable different clock skews.
Wow.
Although the paper says that it has been long been known that seemingly identical computers can have disparate clock skews, it goes on to conclude that the main advantage of our techniques is our technique can be mountable by adversaries thousands of miles or multiple hops away. So that's an interesting way to do computer fingerprinting. And
that's actually really amazing that you can, you know, pinpoint that little clock skew, you know, anywhere on the internet. That's just amazing.
Well, that's the thing, is I think they found a way to fingerprint it, but actually, like, you'd have to fingerprint those, like, let's just say, you fingerprint this one machine and it's not somewhere on the internet, and then it disappears and pops up under another, ISP, IP address, yada, yada, yada. Finding it again, I think, is hard.
Yeah, that's what's just amazing, is it's got to have something that actually sends something out or, creeps around and finds that.
Yeah, and from what I'm getting from this, actually, is that I don't think it does that. I don't think it finds it. I'm thinking...
Well, it does say a semi-passive system.
Yeah, if it did scan the crap out of stuff, it could, find it again. So going through, looking through, thousands...
Because I can see what the passive is, it just sits back, and once it fingerprints something, it has a little, thing that codes, it sends out a little, a little beacon, or a ping.
Not from the machine that got fingerprinted.
Well, how could it be passive and not?
Well, I think it just analyzes the clock skews from a machine and then documents that. And then if it scanned that bank of machines again, and let's just say they scooted the IP addresses around to a different machine, then they could find it yet again. But if you stick it out there on the internet, I think that's one thing that's kind of... In reading the article, if you stick it somewhere on the internet and the millions of trillions of computers that are out there, you'd have to search through all those computers to match that matching clock skew again.
Yeah, that would take a phenomenal amount of time.
Yeah, so if you knew how to pinpoint it and stuff like that. But, if there was, per se, a client on there that sent these skews back, then you could use that as a means to check into Mother Brain or whatever and have that... have that uniqueness down pat for that computer and track it. All right. And, moving right along, fishers face jail time under a new U.S. bill. And what a fisher is, which is a P-H-I-S-H-E-R-S, is basically someone who's out there on the internet masquerading as somebody else, trying to get you to log into a said bank or PayPal or something like that, or eBay. And it's trying to get a password out of you. It's trying to get your account information so it can use that at the legitimate site, and that would be bad for you. Democrat Patrick Leahy has introduced a new federal anti-phishing bill that would impose jail terms of up to 5 years and fines of up to $250,000 for criminals creating fake website designed to consumers and giving them their personal information. Some fishers can be prosecuted under wire fraud or identity theft statutes, but often these prosecutions take place only after someone has been defrauded. They at least plenty of time for for them to cover their tracks. Traditional wire fraud and identity theft statutes are not sufficient to respond to phishing, said Leahy in a statement regarding the Anti-Phishing Act of 2005. Neither phishing nor farming always fit neatly into traditional wire fraud and identity theft statutes, said Leahy. And explaining why the new legislation was necessary, we need to act aggressively to keep them from eroding the public's trust in online commerce and communication. So, I mean, I think that's good that there's going to be something out there to, help legally prosecute phishing, because that's...
Well, yeah, it's like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That now that they can, if they find the site, even though it hasn't committed it, they can take care of it.
Yeah, because they're masquerading already.
Right.
The fact that they're doing that.
It's kind of like how they can bust a drug dealer for having baggies with nothing in it.
Now, the only thing I could think of is for some way skewed thought that somebody could be, doing an anti-website of a specific company, and they, make the website look exactly like the company's website, but everything on their website is, comedic or... political or something like that, and it's really there just to for a freedom of speech kind of thing, but they're like, oh, we're going to get you under phishing because you're acting as if you're us, but and then you got to really say, well, who's going to believe you? It's really you, because
if you can't
it's
read,
it's obviously a parody.
Yeah, if you can't read, yeah, I can see that.
So, all right, and also, now I haven't tried the Microsoft NA Spyware program myself. I don't really have a need to, but I was reading, and I don't know if this is true or not. This is a screenshot, and it sounds like it is true, but I haven't seen it. I haven't done it myself. but it looks to be that the beta version of the Microsoft NA Spyware program actually considers Firefox a threat.
Well, it should.
So, actually, when I post up the show notes, you'll see a link to that to check that out. Okay, a little bit under the weather. So that's kind of interesting. Firefox is a threat. I wonder what the details are on that as to why it's a threat.
Yeah, because like
you would think that it would automatically, if it really was like a spy removal program, it would just take Internet Explorer straight off the machine.
Firefox is so much more secure than anything else. So, like, why?
Yeah, and you know what? I don't think, it's funny because Firefox now, this was just of my own opinion, that when they built it, it does what it needs to do as a web browser. And it doesn't run all these ActiveX controls and all this other stuff, which really, become a part of the problem for, some of the attacks that come with Internet Explorer. And then also, integration with Internet Explorer with like other programs on the computers and stuff like that. So
yeah, so it's a much secure, it's much simpler program. I don't see how it could really become a threat as a spyware device.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's a threat to Microsoft.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right, and for those people that think about reinstalling their copy of Windows XP, they might find that they cannot do the. Well, not as of yet, but believe it's around July, if I look through here again, that you will not be able to activate over the Internet, starting February 28th, activate over the Internet your copy of Windows XP, they're going to require that you call in. Microsoft is closing a loophole that enabled unscrupulous resellers to use Windows XP product keys that were stolen from large OEMs. The results, customers who purchase Windows on a new PC may not be able to reinstall the operating system without first calling Microsoft. The problem lies in the Certificate of Authenticity, the COA, labels on PCs, which often contain unused unique product keys because OEMs pre-install Windows to bypass product activation. These keys could easily be copied and sold by a smaller computer dealer, complete with a counterfeit COA, because the product key was never actually used by an end user. A customer would have no trouble activating Windows via the Internet and never know the difference. But Microsoft plans to change all this starting February 28th, which has already started. Microsoft will indefinitely begin to disable Internet product activation on OEM keys used by the top 20 worldwide PC makers. If a customer attempts to activate Windows XP with an OEM key from a COA, they will be directed to call customer support specialists to obtain an override code, provided they can prove that their copy is legitimate by answering a series of questions. Like, did you steal this copy? Have you ever lied to your mother? Microsoft expects to expand the Internet product activation ban to all pre-activated Windows PCs in the next quarter. Other recent actions that Microsoft has taken against piracy include the Windows Genuine Advanced program, in which Windows users must verify their license in order to access Windows Update and Microsoft Download Center. Incentives such as special downloads and discounts on Microsoft products are offered to users with legitimate licenses. Even non-legit users, however, will continue to receive critical updates to Windows. Personally, when I install Windows, I'm not really like looking to get anything else from Microsoft. I don't know what kind of incentives. I'm kind of curious about what incentives that people might be interested in. I don't know. Free Microsoft mouse. I don't know.
Swag.
Yeah, Microsoft swag, be cool, go hang out at the party with your friends wearing your, Microsoft shirt.
You go, hey, there's the man wearing the man shirt.
Yeah, the man wearing the man shirt.
Yeah.
They should have that Microsoft Manly Company. We're closed source, damn it, and we're proud. All right.
We always keep our boxers on.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. All right. Also, this is very interesting. More news on IBM and their efforts in the open source arena. Basically, IBM software is turning up the noise on its open source contributions. Back in late February, the company said it's contributing some 30 projects to SourceForge.net, a repository of open source code and related material. The Somers NY-based software group also said it expanded its own developer works website with more resources, including training in PHP, hypertext processor, a popular open source programming language for creating web pages, and other popular technologies. It also is working with Zen Technologies on a new DeveloperWorks subsite devoted to PHP. If I remember correctly, DeveloperWorks is a kind of like information library of like tutorials and stuff like that on various things at IBM's website. I've used that for a few different things, and they're pretty good. Actually, Daniel Robbins over at Gentoo, the runner of the man that runs Gentoo, the Linux distribution, actually used to work at IBM and has quite a few tutorials over there. If I'm correct, I believe that's one is the DeveloperWorks. Helping developers out there. A series of Eclipse plugins to help developers link to the IBM CloudScape or Apache Derby databases will also be available from DeveloperWorks. CloudScape and Derby are based on IBM's Informix CloudScape code, but Apache offers the open source version while IBM offers a commercial iteration. Sorry. IBM is also posting web tools for Eclipse on AlphaWorks. These tools promises to cut development time of web applications. Malvin Stein said IBM has already donated more than $40 million worth of code to open source efforts. The Eclipse Foundation evolved out of IBM's own Eclipse framework. She said that there will be more than 30 million downloads of that framework since 2001. The foundation got another boost last week when Holdout BEA Systems threw its weight behind the effort and pledged to support the Eclipse framework in the next version of WebLogic Workshop. Borland and Sybase are also updated up to their participation level in that foundation. So, more help from the IBM community. Now, I don't know what projects that they're submitting. So, you know, I don't know what level of, you know, use they are. But, you know, anything is better than nothing.
Yeah.
How's surfing over there?
Oh, I'm hanging five.
Hanging five.
Yeah.
Right.
It's good stuff over here.
Oh, you know, also, because we could jump into that. I've been playing around with the program AirPone, which is actually released at DEF CON, the last DEF CON. And basically what it does is it takes one wireless card and listens in monitor mode at all the traffic that's out there on an unwept wireless network. I believe there's a wept version, but it's just not released. And then also, as it listens to it, it takes the traffic and looks for certain things, like maybe the downloading of like a JPEG or a certain kind of HTML code. And once it finds that, you give it an action of what to do. Now, one of the things that they did at DEF CON, which was they had all the images, all the JPEGs were replaced with owned. You know, it said owned in the JPEG. And what it does is it takes a second card on the laptop, which acts as an access point. You have to use a Prism 2.5 card. And it sends the response back that the access point would normally send, that the normal access point should send back. But it sends its own response back before the access point that you would normally be associating with sends its response back with and it sends back a fake response. It sends back the response that you want to have it send back. So it basically does wireless injection. And it can do that because, you know, typically when you're surfing something on the internet, it's going to go from, you know, wireless from your machine to the access point out to the internet, grab whatever it is, and then bring it back. Well, the access point that is doing all the injecting has the image or the code or whatever you want on the machine itself, so as soon as it hits the machine that's doing the injection, it sends the information right back before the normal access point can. And then, of course, when the normal access point sends your request back, the TCP packets are out of sequence and they just get dropped. So
that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. So
that took a lot of thought.
Yeah, like this laptop's all set up to do that.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's all set up. So it's pretty funny. They have, you know, you could do all sorts of stuff. Replace images, text, you know, embed something, and replace the whole page with whatever you want. And just, it's, you know, it's interesting fun. And you can use it as a exercise to show that, you know, Wi-Fi is, yet again, you know, subject to another exploit. The I do believe that there is a version that works with Web 1, but the author is not has not released that code. I believe so. I don't know if they do, but I think there is.
It's probably out there somewhere.
But if you want to Google it up, it's Airpwn, AIRPWN. And we had to do a few things to get that to work. We had to modify the make file. We had a problem, but we got it to work. All right. Well, this here is a big move in putting some responsibility on ISPs in Australia. I'm not sure how liable they can be kept. It's I don't know. It can cause a lot of problems. Here it is. ISPs will face fines of up to $55,000 if they can be used to access child pornography and they do not refer the information to the police. Justice Minister Chris Ellison said ISPs and internet client hosts would have strict obligations to report online child pornography to an Australian federal police by March 1st. It cannot be emphasized enough that behind every horrid piece of child pornography is a tragic case of abuse of a defenseless child somewhere in the world. Said Senator Ellison. Under the new laws, an ISP or ICH will face penalties of $11,000 for the individual and $55,000 for the body corporates if they are made aware that their service can be used to access material that may have reasonable grounds to believe is child pornography or child abuse material, and they do not refer details of that material to AFP within a reasonable time. It will also be a federal offense carrying a penalty of 10 years in jail for a person to use the Internet to access, transmit, or make available child pornography or child abuse material. This is on top of the current state and territory penalties. Senator Ellison said it had hoped that the Internet providers would work closely with the AFP's online child exploitation team and the Australian High Tech Crime Center to crack down on the child exploitation and pedophile networks. The AFP last month announced it was also taking part in the International Task Force to Prevent Online Child Abuse. So, how does an ISP know if their service allows to view child pornography?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real question. I mean, I guess they're saying, like, if you found it and somebody says it's there, then you need to find a way to block it.
But then how do you block just normal traffic? Because that's exactly what it is.
Well, you'd have to block to a certain site. Or a certain IP address, or, you know, that's, I guess you can cut down, but, I mean, I guess it could work, but it's just really hard to say that, okay, you know, we told you where it was, and your employee didn't, you know, filter out that website, or somehow they found another way around, and, you know, I don't know how they can, and then they're going to charge them $55,000 because they allowed, you know, they didn't shut the link to the site down. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a good thing to some degree. I just don't know the ins and outs, and the article doesn't really go into saying what that is as to how they filter out, you know, content like that. And then who's monitoring the content? I mean, you know, how do you... I'm assuming that somebody just reports it or you know, I don't understand. Like,
well, yeah, that's... Well, from what that says, that's all they're entitled to do, or they have to do is just report it, because that's all they really can do.
Yeah, I didn't see anything that says, like, they have to monitor all traffic to see if it's there. And then the people that, I mean, who would really report it? I mean, maybe some wife found out her husband's some pedophile and you know, I don't know. But
in some fit of jealous rage because she's no longer five.
Yeah. So, I don't know, but I don't know. I think it's a good thing that people would try to, you know, limit access to that kind of content.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how do you qualify if someone gets fined or not? You know, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, and how much responsibility is it for really an ISP or, you know, to...
Yeah, should they be responsible to filter, you know, the world and certain things in it? So.
Right. Especially if they're just an internet provider. Now, if they're like a portal like AOL or CompuServe, yeah, they have a little bit more control, and they have a little bit more responsibility because they want their users in their system.
You know what? I believe that they should, if maybe this would be a better route, is if there was such thing as a task force that did education about, like, how to track down these things and get rid of these sites and whatnot, and then ISPs could assign, that they could sign up with this task force and say, like, we're this ISP, we're a part of this task force, we engage in, in not allowing traffic to this kind of stuff, and we engage in not carrying these types of traffic, and you know, to
have the non-pedophile seal of approval.
Yeah, to go with that, you know, it's training for the ISP. It's you know, they talk to vendors about equipment that could filter in certain ways, and
well, then it becomes a community. There's shared information. There's new ideas.
Yeah, I think that would be the better route.
And that, you know, you generate more of a community rather than a parent and punisher, you know, situation.
Yeah, and then too, you know, you could it could also be an advertising point where you'd say like, look, do you want to sign up with that ISP's network with your children surfing, or do you want to use ours? We're, you know, so and so approved. You
right,
know?
And that's just basic supply and demand in advertising.
Yeah,
it's great stuff.
So I think that'd be a good route if somebody did that.
Yeah, that's definitely a idea.
Yeah, I wonder. Maybe I shouldn't have said it. Maybe we should start it.
Hey, you know, we still got time.
So, all right. Well, moving right along. Sometimes I like to throw these articles in here. Now, these are I like to delve into the world of science and other things that are happening in the now today, and you know, are going to be moving ideas and thoughts into the future. Basically, there were some creatures that were found in a block of ice that are estimated to be 32,000 years old. And once that ice was thawed...
Oh, is that all?
Yep, just 32,000.
That would make them like the oldest living thing on the face of the planet.
Well, yeah, especially after when they thawed it out, that they were ready to procreate and eat and were moving around afterwards.
Wow.
A new type of organism discovered in the Arctic tunnel came to life in a lab after being frozen for 32,000 years. The deep freeze bacteria could point to new methods of cryogenics, and they are sort of a biology scientists might say exist on Mars and other planets and moons. Excuse me.
But don't you love it how, like, anything unusual, it can live on Mars?
Yeah. If it was able to do this, it
yeah.
could be... on Mars.
But you know, at the same time, if you go from like the snowball Earth theory of you know, what happened to the Earth's history, is that's really like the primordial ooze. It would be those little bacteria. If you're familiar with the global, you know, the snowball Earth theory, is that at one point in time, the entire Earth was a glacier, essentially. And how they figured that there was life before and life after is that around the equator, you know, these sheets of ice were maybe only 20 feet thick or so, and underneath there was still liquid water, and enough sunlight got through which kept the blue-green algae alive. But no, maybe it was those bacteria. Or something like it that thawed out and, you know, started going, hey, I can, you know, I can procreate again, and evolution took off again.
Yeah. The existence of microorganisms in these harsh environments suggests, but does not promise, that we might one day discover similar life forms in glaciers or permafrost of Mars or in the ice crust of the oceans of Jupiter's moon Europa.
Well, you know, in that case, really the only unique thing about that bacteria or that life form that we find on Europa is that we found it on Europa. It's like, hey, we got this thing that's over here on the North Pole that's exactly like it, except that it's here on Earth.
Yeah. NASA described the newfound critter as the first fully described, validated species ever found alive in ancient ice. They immediately started swimming around when the ice melted and added that the cryopreserved bacteria were instantly ready to eat and multiply. The announcement of the discovery comes just a day after the team of European researchers said they found blocks of ice just under the surface of Mars near the equator. The Europeans said the ice is between 2 and 5 million years old. Could serve as storehouses for life.
30,000 years or 5 million. Yeah, you know, those bacteria seem pretty hardy that they can be frozen for 32,000 years. And then come back and do their thing. But 5 million? That's, you know, yeah, that becomes that's a far stretch of the imagination and possibilities for even, you know, strange biology.
The creatures found might be able to survive in their suspended states for millions of years. The discovery opens up a whole new possibility that a future mission to Mars might be able to retrieve any of the life of the, might be able to retrieve any life that's there. Ice samples from this Martian ice sea could contain cryopreserved microorganisms if life flourished on the surface of Mars. Basically, and they're excited about the instant revival qualities of creatures found in Alaska. You might actually get them growing in pure culture, and it would be wonderful if one day, or wonderful if we could retrieve them intact Martian organisms. So,
I think the really neat significance here is that if this bacteria can do that, is there some kind of enzyme or chemical that it produces which allows it to do that? You know, which keeps its DNA intact. You know, its cell structure intact enough when the ice crystals form and rip through it all, and then when, or is it just that simple? Because if it actually has some kind of biological mechanism which allows that to, like, reform or heal itself that quickly, imagine what that would do to, like, you know, cryogenics of us.
Well, it's interesting how, like, their, you know, their ability to come back into motion occurred just after it thawed, you know, like they were paused and unpaused, and the fact that, you know, they weren't like shocked with electricity, you know, it's just heat, and they were ready to,
yeah, it wasn't like Frankenstein's monster,
yeah, so they were ready to come right back. So I don't know what you know, what put them back into motion. That's the one thing when I read the article immediately I was wondering, you know, what was that put them back into motion?
Right. And well, one of the problems
did it just require a heat source, and then boom, things start moving? And
well, one of the problems here, you know, like realistically with cryogenics, so like the, you know, people that get frozen, you know, hope that they get reanimated and all that, is that when cells freeze, and this is what happens with frostbite, is the water in the cells actually expand and form crystals. And those crystals actually rip apart the cell, like the cell organs, rips apart the cell walls, damages everything, and most of the time makes it completely dead, unable to be used. And that's what really fascinates me with these bacteria. Is it just because they're that simple that they're able to do that? Or is there some other biological mechanism which they've evolved and able to do that?
Yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah, that's how, you know, I was thinking of freezer burner, you know, like, yeah, that's another thing. That's
yo, there you go. No more frostbitten meat. What a beautiful thing. You can store a steak for 10 years, pop that baby out, and it'll moo at you.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm.
All right. Well, yeah, so that's interesting. I don't know. There's just so many amazing things out there, and it takes your mind off into the beyond, you know. You know, what's funny is that it's taken so long. You know, I always read articles that even to this day, is there going to be, we found water or ice on Mars. And then there's other articles that said, we might find water or ice on Mars. You know, but I've been hearing that happen for like the last like 10 years. You know, we found it. We might find it. We found it. Well, there might be some there. You know, and like, I don't know, I guess it's there because now it's being reported more and more and more. But
one of my favorite was that there's, you know, ice found on the dark side of the moon. I thought that was brilliant. Why? Because there's no dark side of the moon.
Yeah.
There isn't. So why would ice persist there? In a place which doesn't exist.
It's because we can't see it.
Yeah, so it's those great if.
All right. Well, this is the first time I've ever heard of this before, but I guess it exists. Well, I know it exists, but I've never heard of this term. It's called spam, which is basically spamming over instant messaging. And I have a friend, actually, whenever I get a message from that person, after each message, there's a stupid advertisement for where to go get smileys or some crap, you know, for your instant messenger. And it's actually really annoying. But a U.S. teenager has become the first person to be arrested on suspicion of sending unsolicited instant messages, or spam. Anthony Greco, 18, was lured to New York, from New York to Los Angeles under the pretense of a business meeting. He was arrested upon arrival at Los Angeles International Airport last Wednesday, which is late February. Greco allegedly sent 1.5 million messages advertising pornography and mortgages. According to reports, the recipients of the messages were all members of MySpace.com's online network service. In a further twist upon the scam, Greco had allegedly threatened to share his methods for spamming members of the group if MySpace.com didn't sign an exclusive marketing deal that would have legitimized the messages he was sending via the service. Greco believed that he was flying to Los Angeles to cement the agreement with MySpace president Tom Anderson. MySpace.com launched IM for its messengers members in December of 2003. Reports claim Greco began spamming members using the service in autumn 2004. Assistant U.S. Attorney Bren Hofstadt confirmed the arrest was the first criminal case against an individual sending spam over IM, but he had warned there may well be more to come. We're just beginning to get to the tip of the iceberg. This could be a new wave as online communities start up, he said in a statement. Experts have warned in recent years that spam will be the next area of development for those looking for further exploit access to users' desktops and bombarding them with unwanted messages. Its growth has been slow. So,
well, when there's a will, there's a way.
You know, it's interesting that he's only 18, you know.
Well, yeah, and he's doing some extortion with the big boys. I thought that was pretty nifty.
Yeah. Where's the parents? Where's the parents, man?
Yeah, where's the moral guidance over there?
Yeah.
Like,
teach your kids about spamming, folks.
Hey, Johnny, you know what? You shouldn't extort, you know, MySpace.com. They have more money for lawyers.
Yeah, you know, his dad was like, dude, look, I'll put the contract together. I know a lawyer. Okay? We can do this.
That's probably what it was.
Yeah.
It's like, it's all right, son. You can live here for free as long as you got me in on the profits.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's extremely
annoying. You're going to retire your old man, son. Good job, boy.
Yeah, the problem is that I think people are getting more used to, like, these types of things happening, you know. Oh, there's a pop-up. Oh, there's this. Oh, there's that, you know. Because I know a lot of people, their machines been bombarded with spyware and pop-up and crap for, you know, for months. And they're like, oh, it just came in. I've just been dealing with it. I just close that box 45 times a day, you know. I'm used to it now.
It's just one more process in my incredibly complex, you know, process-ridden life.
Yes.
One more.
So, it sucks, but people are getting used to having that. And, you know, I'm glad that it's being fought back. I don't think that that 18-year-old kid needs to spend 5 years in jail. But I do think he should get a penalty of some kind.
Yeah, make him figure out a way to stop it.
You know what? That would be not too bad.
Yeah.
All right. And also, other news, and I believe that we had talked about this maybe a long time ago, but I'm going to cover it here more fully because I don't believe we did cover it very much before. Basically, the FCC is requiring a broadcast flag be inside of television signals by July 1st of 2005.
Wait, I didn't catch that. What was that?
A broadcast tag. The broadcast tag basically allows you to send information down the line that the television will interpret before a program comes on, and that broadcast flag can say many things like, this show is not allowed to be digitally recorded.
Okay.
And stuff like that. So the EFF is actually on top of it, and here's what they have to say. Today, you can use any device like your television, VCR, TiVo, DVD recorder, and home theater receiver, or a PC combining these functions and more. A year from now, when the FCC broadcast flag mandate takes effect, some of those capabilities will be forbidden. Responding to pressure from Hollywood, the FCC has adopted a rule requiring future digital television DTV tuners to include content protection, a.k.a. DRM, digital rights management technologies. Starting next year, all of the makers of HDTV receivers must build their devices to watch for a broadcast flag embedded in programs by copyright holders when it comes to digital recording. It'll be Hollywood DRM or the highway. Want to burn the recording, burn that recording digitally to a DVD and save hard drive space? Sorry, the DRM lockbox won't allow it. How about sending it over to your home network to another television? Not unless you rip out your existing network and replace it with DRMD routers. Kind of defeats the purpose of getting high-definition digital signal, doesn't it? The good news is that we have until July 1st of 2005 to buy, build, and sell fully capable non-flag-compliant HDTV receivers. Any receivers built now will remain functional under a flag regime, allowing consumers to continue their use without the need for a new or additional equipment. Many devices made until then can be resold in the future.
It's time to stock up on those TVs now.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, you go back and you buy the older technology to get past the crap that they have nowadays. And here's
sounds like a good retirement fund to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got 40 TVs that are not in
DRM free.
Yeah.
Also, this goes right along with it, actually. The U.S. Appeals Court on Tuesday, which was back in late February, said that the regulators had overstepped their authority by imposing a rule designed to limit the copying of digital television programs. You crossed the line, Judge Harry Edwards told a lawyer from the Federal Communications Commission during arguments before a three-judge panel in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Selling televisions is not what the FCC is in the business of, Edwards says, citing that the critics who charged the rule dictates how computers and other devices should work. But it's unclear whether the judges would strike down the FCC's 2003 rule, since doubts were also raised about whether the American Library Association and other opponents had legal standing to challenge the rule in court. After hearing arguments, the court usually takes several months to issue a ruling. The FCC rule aims to limit people from sending copies of digital television programs over the Internet. The FCC has said copyright protections are needed to help speed the adoption of digital television. not for the consumers. under the FCC rule, programmers can attach a code or a flag to digital broadcasts that would in most cases bar consumers from sending unauthorized copies of popular shows over the web. The rule requires manufacturers of television sets that receive digital over-the-air broadcast signals to produce sets that can read the digital code by July 1st of this year. The rule has been criticized by some consumer reports who say that it would raise prices to consumers, and that sets a bad precedent by allowing broadcasters to dictate how computers and other devices should be built. Edwards and one of the two judges, David Centelli, agreed with the critics and told the FCC lawyer Jacob Lewis that the law does not give the agency specific authority to dictate how electronic devices must be made. It has never been done before, Centelli said, agreeing with Edwards that the rule could set a precedent for a wide range of other new FCC regulations, but Centelli also said it had serious doubts whether the Library Association and other critics had standing to sue. Courts have long held that parties have standing only when they can show the agency ruling will cause them a unique, particularized harm. The harm to us is the harm to the consumers, responded Pentelis Michalopoulos, an attorney for the petitioners in our case. Our members are consumers. Company owners are consumers as well. Yeah. So, it just goes on. But, I don't see how they have a right to dictate what goes in the hardware. It's like the whole thing, you know. You take away the guns, you take away the knives, you take away, I don't know, can openers. You take away the ability to copy a movie, you take away, you know, people are still going to be able to do it. You know, you can just take, if you wanted to, a video camera and just point it at your HDTV.
Yeah.
There do it that go. Way.
Yeah, you can't legislate that. Well, you can, but you can't stop it.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not hard to, solder on a video out, or have a video out on your machine, or your screen.
That would be really easy.
Yeah, and video out it, audio out, and you're done. And it just goes to a recording device. So, but obviously, I think they know that. Usually when they do these kinds of things is that the average Joe Blow just can't make it really easy and push a button. But what will happen is the non-Joe Blow people will make the recording and then make it easy to download for the Joe Blow. So,
yeah,
you know, so it's going to get around some way or another. Okay, now this is something that I've always been interested in hearing about, and I'm kind of curious to see where it's going to go. But you know, it's kind of funny when they say, for instance, like I have a printer here, and it said the toner's low, and stop printing. And it said, you got to replace the toner. So what I did is I took the toner out, and I shook it, and I put it back in, and I printed out at least another 60 pages.
Yep.
And the ink is and everything's perfectly clear. Well, there's basically a lady that's suing HP saying that printer cartridges die before they actually have been used. A Georgia woman has sued Hewlett-Packard Company, claiming the ink cartridges for their printers are secretly programmed to expire on a certain date, in some cases rendering them useless before they've even been installed in the printer. The suit filed by the Santa Clara Superior Court in Northern California last Thursday, late February, seeks to represent anyone in the United States who purchased the HP inkjet printer since February 2001, HP being the world's number one computer printer maker. An HP spokesman said the company does not comment on pending litigation. HP ink cartridges use a chip technology to sense how low they are on ink and advise the user to make a change, but the suit claims that those chips also shut down the cartridges at a predetermined date regardless of whether they are empty. The smart chip is dually engineered to prematurely register ink depletion and to render a cartridge unusable through the use of a built-in expiration date that is not revealed to the consumer, the suit said. The suit, which seeks class action status, asks for restitution, damages, and other compensation. Those bastards. That's all I have to say. Because a lot of times, you know, I've seen that. There's ink still in there. It doesn't want to print.
Yeah, I did that today at work. You know, the thing is that it was low on toner, and I was like, that's amazing. I haven't printed that much lately. So I took it out, shook it, put it back in. It's still working.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
You know, they should just say, like, you're running low, and then you'll see when it runs low.
Yeah.
You know, gives you the warning, says you're running low, so you can go buy some more if you choose to.
Right. And then it gives you a little bit of time before it actually starts the quality going bad.
Then you pop in the new one.
Yeah.
So.
But not like 300 copies later.
Yeah, it's like you're running low. Replace it now. You know, you don't. What about that print that may get a little sketchy? Then I'll put in a new damn cartridge, and there we are. So.
Ooh, if I have to do one twice. Oh, darn.
Damn it. The time lost there costs you.
A whole quarter.
Yeah. All right. Well, we now know, we've always known that ICANN has been the governing body for how the name, top-level domain names and stuff like that get distributed and created and whatnot. basically, the UN is proposing a panel to move that power over to the United Nations. Since...
Ooh, that's scary.
That's a, you know, type of system that everybody uses, but is run by ICANN here in the United States. A UN-proposed panel aims to settle a long-running tug-of-war control over the Internet by July and propose solutions to problems such as cybercrime and email spam. Of course it's because of cybercrime and email spam. The panel...
Fear, fear, and more fear.
Yeah. I'm sure they could be, but not totally. The panel set up in December 2003 will lay groundwork for a final decision. decision to be taken in Tunis in November at a UN-sponsored world summit in the Information Society on the Information Society, where global control of the World Wide Web may be decided. Right now, the most recognizable internet governance body is the California-based nonprofit company, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN. But developing countries want an international body such as UN's International Telecommunications Union, ITU, to have control over governance from distributing website domains to fight spam. Distributing website domains to fight spam.
That's really weird.
Yeah. There is an issue that is out there and needs to be resolved, said Nini. Nitin Desai, chairman of Working Group and Special Advisor to UN Security, General Kofi Annan, incorporating while its oversight has been confirmed to Techno Matters, critics say that it's subject to U.S. political influence. The ITU, a 138-year-old trade body that, among other things, established country code rules for international telephone calls, is seen by developing countries as better able to address their needs. So I really don't care who has it, actually, as long as they just don't screw it up. But, yeah, you know, maybe that's going to be fair. But I'm not opposed to it, I guess. It's not that ICANN is friends with them. I mean, so, yeah, that's fine by me if they move it over. It just depends on, you know, what rules and policies and what kind of changes that they want to implement is really what it's all about. So that I don't know. but it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure that there will be some sort of sharing or some sort of compromise made. All right, and then moving on to other news. This is something that I've seen before, and Intel is looking to build this into the chip itself. Basically, computers that are under heavy bandwidth usage are constantly writing those TCP/IP packets, UDP, or whatever types of packets that they need to be writing. TCP/IP is the most common one. And while the processor is writing those and working on other things, instead of having the processor do all that work, or basically, the idea is to farm out the computing of the TCP/IP packets. Basically, Intel next year will plan itself square in the middle of a budding marketing for systems that speed network traffic by rolling out something called I/AROAT. IOAT stands for I/O Acceleration Technology, and it will be previewed for the first time next month's Intel Developer Forum in San Francisco. Intel remains cagey about what exactly IOAT is, but is dangling a few details today in front of reporters ahead of the IDF event. This will solve the problems that we've heard about a lot of enterprise customers, said an Intel spokesman. The problems in question relate to network slowdowns that occur as servers try to crunch for the TCP/IP stack. Customers often finding out that their servers spend an inordinate amount of time dealing with network traffic when they should be hammering away on application data. To end that, a number of companies, such as Zaptec and Alacritech, have developed TOE cards for TCP/IP offload engines. These cards plug into servers or storage systems and handle much of the network traffic. Intel plans to sidestep the need for the separate TOE cards by building this technology into its server processor package, the chip itself, the chipset and network controller. This should reduce some of the time a processor typically spends on waiting for the memory to feed back information and improve overall application processing speeds. Intel expects this technology to debut as a standard part of the server products in 2006. It will also have a tight storage component to the IOAT project, but won't say word one about what that storage component may be. Companies have typically tried to handle the TCP/IP stack problem with network storage systems. Thus far, TOE cards haven't proved terribly popular in part of their relatively high costs and lack of widespread support. Companies such as Sun Microsystems have talked about developing their own TOE card style technology and about dedicated parts of multi-core processors to handling TCP/IP and security traffic. So, thinking about the IBM Cell processor that we talked about in the last show, where it actually has 9 cores, one to maintain the 8, and you can delegate tasks to the other cores. So that processor is amazing to me. So this is just offshoring some of this these tasks to other processes.
Well, that's good delegation work.
Yeah. Okay, and an interesting fun fact for people out there that enjoy Linux. You know, they talk about Linux on desktops versus Windows and stuff like that. Well, Linux on robots seems to beat out Windows 10 to 1.
I mean,
10 to 0, actually.
I wonder why.
Yeah. The publishers of Windows for devices and Linux devices websites published an annual comparison of Linux versus Windows and products mentions on their news sites. While both are still roughly tied, Linux has gained ground in areas including PDAs and mobile phones. Perhaps the gain is due to the discovery of Windows viruses on mobile phones or the recent high-profile failure of Windows-based embedded air traffic control system due to a trivial time bug. They also note that Linux is the number one choice in Asia now, where embedded device manufacturers want to avoid vendor lock-in and expensive per-unit Microsoft licenses. But the most interesting part is that in the U.S. In the robotics category, they show 10 Linux-based commercial robots and 0 running Windows. So free software is apparently beating out closed proprietary software, hands down, in this field. So I wonder why. Because they can just grab it and develop it and work on it. And obviously it's a cost thing. They don't want
to... Well, and also they can change it and make it do whatever they need it to.
Yeah, they don't have to read those nasty Microsoft comments in their code that Microsoft doesn't want people to see. Which would be inappropriate. Also, this isn't such a big thing, but and I've thought about it much before, but I guess now somebody decided to write an article about it. A lot of times, virus software looks for certain types of files, right? Zip files, one comes to mind, because there's stuff in the zip file, and people grab it, and they open it, and click it, and they're like, what's this? Well, a new thing that isn't so new, it's always been there, but it's being reported now, is that there is an emergence. This is what's new, the emergence of rarepacked viruses. .rar is an archive. It does compression, and actually, I don't know if it does compression, but I do know it'll take one file and split it up amongst like multiple rares, and then once you and then you can break it out and do all sorts of things. But it's a packaging system, and I'm sure it probably does compression. I haven't used it in a while, but a lot of people would take zips actually and put them inside the rares, and then you could open up the rare and there's your zip, and it might be a zip that's spread across a few rares and whatnot. But anyways, most antivirus systems allow the .rar file to go through because it just has been a threat in the past, typically. So that's the news when it comes to that. You know, opening up anything. It's just the idea is to watch whatever you open up. Excuse me. All right. And to wrap up the show, this is something that I found interesting, is that people out there that are doing blogs have lost their jobs because of some of the things that they've talked about.
Interesting.
Workers with blogs are everywhere, and they're talking, and they're starting to make corporate America very nervous. Mark Chen landed a dream job with Google Inc. in January, and he was fired less than a month later. His infraction, he ran a weblog where he freely gabbed about his impressions of life at the Mountain View, California-based internet search giant. Weblogs are blogs. The online personal diaries where big names and no names expound on everything from pets to presidents are going mainstream. While still a relatively small piece of total online activity, blogging has caught on with affluent young adults, as Forrester Research Analysis recently noted. Blogging will become increasingly common as the consumers age. For companies, the growing popularity of blogs is a double-edged sword. On the other hand, corporate managers recognize the power of the word of mouth as a sales tool. On the other hand, they're actually aware of the dangers inherent in the rapid and widespread dissemination of company information. Former Delta Airlines flight attendant claims she was fired in November over pictures she posts on her personal blog that she says the airline deemed inappropriate. Friendster, an online social networking site, canned an employee last summer for her online musings about the company. And a Microsoft contractor lost his gig after posting on the web photos of Apple computers arriving at software giant's Redmond, Washington headquarters. We actually talked about that on one of the shows. Ellen Simonetti, the former Delta stewardess whose Queen of the Sky online persona got her fired, has filed a discrimination complaint with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. The operators of the site started by Apple claims their postings, like those of a newspaper article, are protected under the First Amendment.
Yeah, seems like it. Unless they're using like company equipment and time and all that.
Well, actually, the First Amendment only protects you from the government, not private corporate entities or private. Cliff Palaskai of San Francisco employment lawyer says that there's a false sense that employers, and I'll get something later that is interesting though that does combat it, can't punish their workers for voicing personal opinions or their blogs or anything else. People mistakenly believe that the First Amendment protects them in the workplace, which is generally not the case, he said. There are a handful of exceptions. Several states, including California, specifically protect workers from retaliation of their political views. Other states have broader protections covering off-the-job activities, said Pelosi. The Apple, in a lawsuit filed California State in December, claims the product leaks violated its trade secrets and wants the site operators to disclose the source's identity, but Absahal counters that that the site operators, like news reporters, are protected under the First Amendment, as well as California state law. Eugene Volok, a UCLA law professor and expert in free speech on the internet, said that the journalist's defense is potent, that there's just no way that Apple can win. Even if Apple Computer and companies triumph in their campaigns against bloggers, their ability to control online diarists is inherently limited, said Doug Eisenberg, an Atlanta lawyer and operator of Gigalaw.com, a yada yada yada. The problem with a lot of these issues is once the cat is out of the bag, the information has been disclosed, it can't be undisclosed, said Eisenberg. A lot of these companies are trying to do is to deter other people from doing the same kind of things. So if you actually act as a journalist and you're just reporting news, then you're...
Then it is protected.
Yeah, and if it's not protected information to begin with and it's reported, then you should be protected.
Yeah.
I don't know what qualifies someone as a journalist. If you actually have to be a journalist, you know. I don't know if when they started newspapers back in the day that they went to, you know, that they're certified journalists. I think people just wrote, and if they got a printer, they were set. But I don't know what the laws are nowadays. But, yeah.
That's, yeah.
So say you're a blogger / journalist. You're journaling your life and whatever comes along in it.
Sure.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for me for the show.
Wrapping it up with a little bow tie.
And a little bow tie. Okay. Once again, we're trying to get these shows up as fast as we can. Lots of things going on out there, but we're out here, and we're still going to keep bringing the show. So stay tuned, and we'll be seeing everybody here pretty soon.
Good, good.
All right, this is Slip Mode signing out, saying see you again soon, bringing the news, and spreading the word.
This is VR Sam later.
say it is just us. It seems like an awful waste of space.
You're tuned into Perfecto Radio, Chicago, Detroit, Seattle.